Welcome to Found It TU, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa. And today we're here with Aaron Iske, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at the University of Tulsa. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you, Jolie. I'm very excited to be here.
Glad to have you here. Well, as you know, we begin each podcast with the very same question, which is to ask you to tell us in one simple sentence what you study.
I study the interaction of molecules and atoms on surfaces.
Great sentence. So what we'll find out while we're talking is why that's interesting,
exactly.
Right? So how did you get interested in this topic?
Basically, it was born when I joined a particular research group at Tufts University, where I went for my PhD.
This is after you were here
that's
as an
right.
undergraduate,
that's
right?
So I went to TU. I graduated in 2005 with my bachelor's in chemistry. I went on to graduate school at Tufts University. While there, their kind of program is to let you see all the different professors that do research. And one of the ones that presented was a new professor. He was a British professor. And he started talking about this microscope called a scanning tunneling microscope. And what this microscope can do, which is what's so cool about it, is it can visualize, it can take pictures of single atoms and molecules. Truly, truly revolutionary. They won the Nobel Prize in 1986 to German scientists for the invention of this microscope.
Tell us again, scanning?
Scanning tunneling microscope. And oftentimes we love to use acronyms. So occasionally you may hear me say STM, and that's what I'm referring to. So it's a very unique instrument. It's gotten more popular over the course of time, but there's probably a few hundred of them around. And so Dr. Charlie Sykes presented his research and gave interested graduate students the potential to join. And because of my undergraduate experience here at TU, because I was involved in TURC and also CSERP, which stands for Chemistry Summer Undergraduate Research Program, I was actually chosen above some of the other students to join his lab.
Oh, wonderful.
And it was really, really great. So that was the birth of looking at atoms and molecules every day, taking pictures of them.
And so you're really at the cutting edge. If this was a relatively new technology.
Exactly.
And you were able to be one of the first to be able to use it.
It's very exciting. And it still really is being developed.
Well, let's move straight to the kinds of things that you have been able to research. Tell me what, so you're on postdoc research.
That's right.
Working in a research lab with this new kind of microscope, seeing things for the first time,
that's
really,
right.
at this
that's
level.
Right. That's right. And one of our kind of most famous and, in fact, most exciting discoveries during my PhD work was the world's smallest electric motor.
Hmm.
And so what this means, if you break it down, first of all, it's a motor, which means we can control its movement, but it's a single molecule. So it's a molecule made up of sulfurs and carbons. It's a small molecule. But what happens is the sulfur atom acts as an anchor, and it anchors it to the surface. And then the carbon chains just rotate around the sulfur. And we could take pictures of this with the STM. Really, really amazing.
Oh, my heavens.
We discovered that we could control whether it was clockwise or counterclockwise with our STM tip. And this allowed us to really discover the first ever single molecule electric motor. And this, of course, got us into the Guinness Book of World Records. So it's kind of not something that always happens when you're getting your PhD, but really cool, like something you'll remember.
Oh, yeah. What a treat.
Yes.
So I'm being rocketed back to my grade school, you know, styrofoam balls with little things sticking out of them.
Yes.
And so basically what you're describing is what we could imagine in first grade when
right.
we were doing that. It turns,
yes.
and you were able to say to use tip?
Yes. So how the microscope works is we take an atomically sharp tip. So what that is, it's a piece of metal wire that's very, very sharp at the end. Basically, it has a single atom at the very end. We bring that very close to a conductive surface, so something like a metal, and then we can use that tip and the tunneling phenomenon to actually image these single molecules. And so the tip kind of acts like a record player going over a surface. The tip is reacting to what's on the surface and telling us what's there.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you're taking photographs and
that's
seeing
right.
pictures,
so,
but you're seeing it in real time.
In real time, which is really, really amazing.
Mm-hmm. And you're in the Guinness Book of World Records.
That's right.
Cool.
So Tufts University is in there. Our individual names didn't make it.
You know you're there.
That's right.
Well, so that was at Tufts. Now tell us about your TU research.
So at TU, we're still using the scanning tunneling microscope, but what we're doing is we're actually taking that tip and we're dipping it into a liquid. And so we're actually dipping the tip into a liquid layer and studying atoms and molecules at room temperature and under a liquid. Now, this is truly unique. There's probably, honestly, about five groups in the world really focusing on what we call a fancy term, in situ STM. Mm-hmm. And why many people aren't doing it is because it is very noisy and messy. You're dealing with working at room temperature, which is an issue if you're trying to see single atoms. These atoms actually move at room temperature. That's enough thermal energy for atoms to kind of move and stretch. And what that does is it causes some issues that we can get around with the software called thermal drift. And we have ways of working around that. In addition to that, I mentioned we're in a liquid. This is really great because it protects our surfaces and keeps them clean. But it also, the surface itself can sometimes cause some issues with imaging. And so we've worked over the last 6 years at becoming kind of the forefront of using this technique and still looking at atoms. But now at relevant conditions. And this is what's really important about our work.
So more natural or more everyday conditions rather than, so what are other labs doing?
So they are mostly working at something called ultra high vacuum. It basically just means they're working in a metal chamber. The STM is in a metal chamber that's been pumped out, meaning there's very few free particles in there. What's very cool about ultra-high vacuum is it actually approaches the pressures of outer space. So we're actually removing everything from the inside of these instruments so that when we look at the surface, it's very, very clean and we know exactly what we're looking at. The other thing that these STMs typically use is low temperature. So they'll go down to very low temperatures using liquid nitrogen and liquid helium to slow down the movement of atoms and molecules.
And reduce that thermal drift
you mentioned. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, we're like, we just say, screw it all, and we're going to put you in liquid at room temperature and see what we can find out. And that's been really fun.
And you were saying using particular ways of sort of eliminating the noise
That's right. Software corrections. We also scan really fast. So the tip itself actually goes back and forth really fast, and that helps a lot. So it can get an image pretty quickly, and that helps.
Well, so you mentioned that other labs can mimic, it's more like what's like in outer space. So mm-hmm. I'm taking it now that your techniques are more like it is in everyday life.
Exactly.
So that whatever you discover is more like what's really going on.
That's exactly it. And that's a great segue, actually, into our recent NSF award. So I wrote a grant last fall. The idea behind it was really bridging between the ultra-high vacuum world, this kind of specialized, pristine, beautiful model world, and the real world, mm-hmm. and the kind of messy, noisy real world. And I have a lot of experience in UHV over 10 years, my PhD and my postdoc. And so what we proposed was to work with Argonne National Lab, which is outside of Chicago. They have a UHV STM that I worked on during my postdoc. We're going to basically use that microscope along with our microscope here at TU and make a bridge comparison between the exact same systems. And really, no one else is proposing to do this because really you either live in one of two worlds and you very rarely try to bridge the gap between them. And so this was my first big NSF award as an assistant professor.
Congratulations. An honor.
It was very exciting. Yeah.
And so the research is starting now
It's starting. Oh. So a lot of it involves travel back to Argonne, but I send my graduate students so they can have experience on these high-end instruments. And then they come back with some images, and then we do the same systems here at TU.
As I understand it, you'll be publishing your findings over time.
That's
how
right.
long is the grant for?
So the grant is 2 years, which is relatively short. but we've already made progress. We've actually submitted two papers. One's under review right now. So
you're already finding exciting stuff that's publishable.
Exactly.
And your graduate students like you get to be on the cutting edge
that's
of
right.
things that have never been done before.
To kind of give back.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
great. So a lot of times we like to ask about applications and how your findings can apply, help. So tell us.
So that kind of requires me to explain probably our two main projects. So our first one is looking at a atomically thin, so a single layer of silver atoms that we put on top of a gold surface. And we do this very specifically using electrochemistry. But when we put this single silver layer on the gold, we found it actually gave the gold more thermal stability, meaning this layer actually persisted when we heated it up to 1,000 Kelvin or 730 degrees Celsius. We saw that the silver layer remained on the surface. This isn't expected. At 730 degrees Celsius, you would most likely vaporize a single layer. Well, the silver stayed. And I discovered this during my PhD project, but we kind of were just on the brink of understanding what was happening. And so now here at TU, we've dived back into that silver layer. And we've published a paper in Surface Science on it in August, where we're really understanding it's exactly how you lay the silver down specifically that gives us this thermal, and also it's also protected against oxygen, which is really interesting. The application for this is the idea of protecting electronic components as we start making our electronics smaller and smaller, so the miniaturization of electronics, we're having to deal with this larger and larger actual creation of heat. These are all still working components, and they're getting smaller and smaller. Where does this heat go? Well, we can see some kind of terrible examples of things exploding under pillows and airplanes, for example.
I've all heard of those.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the question is, you know, how do we begin to make these materials withstand higher heat as we concentrate the power density? And so it's a very large application, but it is something that we're working on in my lab. So we want to extend this thermally stable layer to different surfaces is the idea.
So no more exploding cell phones, thanks to your research.
That's the hope. Yeah. We'll sell that.
Well, sure. So you mentioned two projects.
That's right. So we have our silver on gold. And then the other one is really interesting. This is a lot more to do with that NSF grant. It's looking at amino acids. So amino acids are just the molecules inside of the proteins in our body. So essentially, your DNA is ultimately made up of amino acids. What we're doing is we're looking at how those amino acids grow on a surface. So if we put down a few amino acids, what does it look like? If we put down more, how do they propagate? How do they grow across the surface? What's really interesting about this is in early life systems.
You mean way back.
So at the very, when biological molecules first began existing on this planet, they didn't exist in a perfect symmetry. And what I mean is molecules can have a handedness. You can imagine them as being left-handed or right-handed. Now, one would think over the course of time, you would have 50% left, 50% right. It turns out all of the biological molecules in our body, all of the amino acids, are of a left-handed nature. So somewhere along the way, left-handed won the race. It won the evolutionary race, supposedly. And the real question, I mean, this is going to be years, years, years in the making, but why is it left-handed? What is so special? In addition to that, in these early life systems, we know that surfaces were around. There were probably rocks and clay and minerals. Well, I've recently been working with some groups actually at NASA where they're really kind of trying to understand the chemistry that could be happening at these surfaces along with the birth of these biological molecules and how eventually this led to kind of left-handed structures, which are now in our protein and DNA.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, it's very huge. But because my microscope or the microscope that I work on works in liquid and at room temperature, we're now mimicking much more closely. We can also control the pH of our liquid so we can make them more acidic. And it turns out that acidic liquids were probably what were around in early Earth. And we're learning this again with our collaboration with NASA. But so we're really making these systems specifically to mimic what may have been around. So really, really exciting.
Wow, yes. Yeah. And I assume years and years of
years.
Nuances
That's
that you
right.
can explore.
And hopefully
with
lots
this.
Of funding.
Which is the way science proceeds.
Yes.
Indeed. Well, it's exciting, especially with that room temperature and in liquid, which
That's
makes
right.
this, you know, only you under these conditions could do this work.
Yes. Very fun.
Wow. And so let's talk about fun a little bit.
Okay.
So,
okay.
What do you like most about doing your research?
One is the uniqueness of the instrument. You know, it's kind of twofold. We go to conferences and we really have to kind of argue, why are our images not so perfect? Why are they not so pristine? But then we get to say, but we're at relevant conditions. Like, how exciting we're still able to see these atoms and molecules. And it really begins to start to change kind of the overall dynamic of some of the of some of my peers and colleagues at other universities to start thinking about how things may or may not change when you go to relevant conditions. So I love showing are perfect, some of our most beautiful images, people won't believe. They won't believe they were taken at room temperature in liquid because they're so great. We have specific examples of this, but people often joke with me, are you sure that that's not an ultra-high vacuum? And it's not, you know?
Yeah.
So that's been really fun. And then at TU, working with the students, I mean, the students here are just very motivated for research. They come and help every day. Even the undergraduates are here working late, helping me. And that's, on days when I'm tired, it's the students that really, and they're excited and they want to see what happens next. So that's great. Yeah.
So how do you get your students into the lab? Do they start out as undergraduates? In your classes? And then they...
Often, you know, it's been both. Because some of my best students I've had in general chemistry, because I typically teach in the fall, so right when they first come to TU. And then they'll hear me talk about the STM, and then they'll ask to join my lab. I've had students for 4 and 4.5 years as undergraduates because they'll stay. I've also had really great students kind of come later in their careers, but a recent student actually came as an undergraduate and is now going to stay for her master's. So that's really...
Does that happen to... I would think that once you get hooked on this...
She's the first one that's happened for me, but that would be the hope. That would be a great kind of bridge between undergraduate and grad school here at TU.
There aren't a lot of women in hard sciences. And tell us about how it has been for you and what we can do to encourage other young women
to
participate.
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been mostly fortunate in that my PhD advisor and my postdoc advisor, both male, but were incredibly encouraging. So I was, in many ways, I was encouraged along the way. Now, you know, as you go to conferences and as you start to go on job interviews, you start to see, there's fewer and fewer women in the room, and that's kind of an interesting feeling. Here at TU, everyone has been very supportive. There has not been a tenured female in my department yet.
Oh.
And so this is, you know, it's really important. Tenure is important for so many reasons, but I think there's also the kind of societal impact of having a tenured woman in my department. I have many students who write me and come up to me, female students, who say how meaningful it was to them to have me or see me in the department. Now, we have had a new department member, another female join in our biochemistry department, so that's been really great. In terms of encouraging, I've basically found that it's almost your presence that's encouraging, having an open door policy. I've been working to create a new group here at TU called Women in ENS, ENS standing for Engineering and Natural Sciences. And so what we're doing is we're bringing together all of the female students for the first time ever and giving them a kind of a forum to be together and to just kind of have a community of support. I find that when I get a group of female students together, they'll actually kind of start talking and they'll start to feel more comfortable. And oftentimes I'm able to help them more directly in those kind of situations. So it's not that there's ever been kind of one thing that's happened, but I have just found that through my years here, how important it is just to have female scientists around and to show that it is an option and that we're just as qualified.
To make it seem as normal and natural
as
possible.
Exactly.
Do you think we need to start earlier in high schools then?
Oh, yes. And even before high school. So we have a couple of camps. I've even been involved with a group called Tech Track, where we worked with middle school girls. So 7th grade girls came into my lab for a whole week. And we would interview them, or they would kind of have an interview before and after. And when it was over, they would say, you know, I'm really, you could see a marked trend. And now I'm thinking about college in specific areas of STEM. And that was through their experience of getting exposed to it as 7th graders. So it'll be really interesting to see where those 7th graders go, because it was probably only 4 years ago that I started that, or we started working with that. So that's called Tech Trek. So very, very fun. But the earlier, the elementary school would actually be the best. But you always need those teachers. I had specific teachers along the way, female and male, who really took me under their wing and really changed my life. So we all need those good teachers.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to follow up because you're so enthusiastic. Tell me, can you capture for us the excitement of really, I mean, get us start drill down a little bit. Can you tell us a moment that has been memorable to you in the lab, or where you felt like, this is why I do this work, that's tied to the science part?
Yes. Well, I will say the very first day of CSERP last summer, our undergraduate research program, the very first day, they text me because my lab's in the basement, my office is on the middle floor. Anyway, they text me, we're seeing something strange in the images. Can you come down? So I come down and I look at the images, and we were actually seeing, the metal surface that we look at typically is gold. And we were seeing the gold grow these kind of fingers across the surface. They were these kind of long, they were made out of gold, but they were growing as the tip kept scanning across the surface. They were growing in length. And all of a sudden, I remembered a paper that Professor Sykes, Charlie, had talked mm-hmm. about during my PhD work, and it was a paper called On Magic Gold Fingers. And I all of a sudden remembered this paper, and we rushed to pull it up. And sure enough, we were seeing these magic gold fingers that no one had ever seen outside of UHV. And this was the first day of research last summer. And they kept saying, can we publish it? Can we publish it? And I said, well, we have to see it at least two more times. And we need mm-hmm. to, really understand. But that is actually the paper that's under review right now at Surface Science, is the magic gold fingers, first time ever seen under what we call relevant conditions.
Right.
So
right.
That was a great moment. And it was undergraduates and my graduate student who just defended his PhD.
Mm-hmm. They must think it happens all the time now, too.
Right. I was like, this is not.
Well, so let's paint a more realistic mm-hmm. picture. Mm-hmm. I mean, these epiphany moments mm-hmm. must be, it's like intermittent reinforcement in psychology. It sure. keeps you coming back for more, right? Mm-hmm. So are there moments of drudgery? And what are those like, and what keeps you going through them?
That's a great question. Definitely talk to my grad student about that. There have been, I would say, weeks on end where we weren't getting great resolution with the microscope, meaning we couldn't see atoms and molecules. And oftentimes it's because something's not clean, or perhaps the tip isn't sharp, or there's something going on with the software. And it's really hard for the students to keep coming in and seeing an image that's just terrible. And basically what we do is we kind of break down the steps. Okay, you try this, and then you try this. And so for us in science, you change one variable at a time. It's really important mm-hmm. for us. But I have found that one thing that that helps the students would be teamwork. So I've never really have a student working alone. Huh. So they're always team building, team working. There's kind of a mentor-mentee type of mentality. And so when one gets burned out, there's always another to come and say, let's keep going, or go take a break. But drudgery is 100% part of this. I would say half of my PhD, I wasn't getting anything. Mm. And we always talk about the light at the end of the tunnel, the publication at the end of all of this. And I think for undergraduates, that's kind of hard to imagine. Many of them have never published a peer-reviewed paper, so they don't even know kind of how that works. But I will say that no one has ever given up. No one has walked away. No one has quit. So we take these moments, and then we kind of reminisce, remember that time. And then we just treat it. I said, even a failed day in research, we still learned something. And so we don't make that mistake again.
Well, that leads me to this larger question about the nature of science. Mm-hmm. And so could you tell you a little bit more about why you test one variable at a time mm-hmm. and why science shouldn't be treated as something super remote, mm-hmm. but actually is a kind of codification of mm-hmm. processes we use every day right. to try to figure out what's true or what's trustworthy?
Exactly. Well, and so first of all, the concept of changing one variable at a time is obviously if you change multiple ones, you don't know which affected it. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of very clear, maybe we'll change something about the solution, and then the next day we'll change the tip, and then so on. But I think there are ways to approach kind of your everyday life in the sense that if something doesn't work, you try something else. We can't ever, with research, we try really hard to keep our emotions out of it. So mm-hmm. the frustrations, I have found that very frustrated students will break things by accident. The parts of our microscope are incredibly tiny. And so what we say is, you come into the lab kind of emotion free, and then we can make decisions that are based on the kind of factual understanding of how the microscope works or what we're looking for. But I have found that science or my research, often if I'm having kind of a super emotional or bad day, it actually pulls you out. Because you have a goal, you have something you can come in and do. And for many of my students who are struggling, the research has really been something that they can fall back on. And they can come work, and then they can step away from the stress, perhaps, of the day and just work. And then you have to leave at some point. They don't. But, have to leave at some point and re-engage. But I think that this idea of tackling problems unemotionally has been very helpful and kind of a quote.
Systematically and unemotionally,
yeah,
it sounds
you know,
like.
Mm-hmm. What makes the most sense? What have we seen in the past? You know, we're not really reinventing the wheel. We're really just doing our process and making sure we're being really careful. But I think that's the best way that we've approached it so far.
Also, from what you're describing, it's cumulative. In other words, you're building on your own previous findings, but also the findings of others across the globe,
exactly.
Right? You're never alone.
Never
this
alone.
Image of the scientist alone and usually male
right.
in a white lab coat, you know, eureka,
right.
Isn't
right.
the really
oh, no.
the way it works.
We are so on the back of so many people, and, you know, the inventors of our microscope, all the way through people in, that we'll never meet, you know, that we just read their papers and we say, oh, we're seeing something similar. Sometimes we reach out to them depending on if we have questions, and sometimes they get back to us. But it's a community, and it's a worldwide community where science is our language, and kind of we get to talk to people all over the world. I've also traveled all over the world getting to explain my science, and so that's another true benefit. It makes a community not out of where you're from, but of what you're doing
mm-hmm.
and what you're finding.
And so can you give us a little glimpse of what it's like when you get together with your community of wizards from around the world talking about your special
yeah,
corner of it?
It's well, you know, I will say that sometimes it seems like people are fighting, but it's actually just very impassioned scientists who really kind of argue their point, or they're kind of arguing their science. It's a very kind of different metaphor than actually arguing because it's based on data and results.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes these meetings are quite people will raise their hands. There's a lot of discussion. Like I said, our images, our systems are very unique. So I'm often spending a lot of time explaining exactly how we got the images. You know, once in a while, you kind of get the person who doesn't believe in what you're showing, but you kind of move on.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of excitement in the surface science world. Surface science is really going to be kind of at the forefront of what's being discovered. And so we're really excited about where this is going. I mean, quantum computing, for example, this is surface science, making computers out of single atoms and molecules. I mean, I have some of the most interesting colleagues that I get to go to conferences with. It's really exciting. So.
Well, I assume our listeners are just as excited to hear about this. And so I wanted to make sure they knew about your website.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit long, and it's also, you can find it on the TU website, but I'm going to go ahead and read it out. So it's ISKI, I-S-K-I, research.wixsite.com/UTulsa. So if you go there, you can see all of our research and our publications. And there's also a ton more of information on the kind of chemistry TU website as well.
Okay, so more about the specifics there. And if listeners are interested in knowing more about women and women
mm-hmm.
in science?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the books I've been reading recently, which actually a student gave to me, which is obviously remarkable in its own sense, but it's called Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. And basically, it's just, and it's filled with beautiful illustrations, but on each page, it has a different women scientist and kind of explains her story, both where she came from, some of her hardships, and then ultimately what she discovered or what she went through. For example, Rachel Carson is one of the ones that
Silent Spring.
Mm-hmm. I loved her. Somehow I learned about her in elementary school and got really obsessed with Silent Spring back then in elementary school. Valentina Tereshkova is in here about the USSR and the first female flight around the Earth, which is really amazing. Valentina is my middle name, so I feel kindred spirit. But it's very short, the stories in this book, so you can just pick it up and read one before you go to bed.
So. Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It TU, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa here on the TU campus. We've been talking with Erin Iske, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at TU, about her research in nanoscale surface chemistry. Please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss in everyday language the nature and value of their research.